Our second case this morning is United States against Bragg. Counsel for the defense.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Major Brian Jackson. I represent the appellant in this case. And the sole question before this court is whether the military judge erred when he denied appellant's challenge for cause against a prospective member, Lieutenant Colonel Woods. In light of Lieutenant Colonel Woods' statement on the record that he could be fair, and the military judge's observation of that statement, the issue in this case is not one of actual bias, but one of implied bias, and in particular, the application of the liberal grant mandate. Now, the appellant asserts that Lieutenant Colonel Woods' responses during voir dire conclusively demonstrate that the military judge's denial of the appellant's challenge created an objective appearance of unfairness in the eyes of the public. Now, we know that the appellant was a recruiter.
That's hard to conclusively demonstrate, though, isn't it?
We don't believe so, sir.
That you can conclusively demonstrate what the public would perceive?
Correct. I stand corrected.
Okay. Sorry, but...
Yes, sir.
I was just trying to figure out if you knew something I didn't, because it sure would make these cases easier if you could. Okay.
But on an objective standard, we need to prove that, sir. We know that the appellant was a recruiter. In the 12th Marine Corps District in Riverside, California, when one of his prospective recruits alleged that he sexually assaulted her on 10 April 2003. That's when the allegation surfaced. We know also that during that same time frame, between 10 April 2003 and 17 July 2003, Lieutenant Colonel Woods was the Assistant Chief of Staff recruiting. He was Assistant Chief of Staff for the Commanding General, MCRD, San Diego. The same commanding general who convened this particular court-martial that appellant faces here. We know that one of Lieutenant Colonel Woods' duties as Assistant Chief of Staff recruiting was to review allegations of misconduct made against recruiters. When these allegations of misconduct were sufficient enough and severe enough, they amounted to a relief for cause package that contained the investigation into those allegations. Then we learned from Lieutenant Colonel Woods during his voir dire that his duty as Assistant Chief of Staff was to review those investigations, to review those relief for cause packages, and make a determination as to whether he believes that that particular Marine or that particular recruiter should be relieved for cause. He was tasked to form an opinion. Then he was tasked to advise his commanding general, the commanding authority here, whether or not he believed the commanding authority should remove that particular appellant for cause from his duties as a recruiter. Now, as it happened, on 4 June 2004, the commanding authority appointed that same Lieutenant Colonel Woods, to sit as a panel member in appellant's trial. And during voir dire of Lieutenant Colonel Woods, Lieutenant Colonel Woods candidly told the military judge, the trial counsel, no less than three different times that he probably reviewed appellant's relief for cause package, that he probably made a recommendation to the commanding general, the commanding authority, that the appellant should be relieved for cause. On the last time he said this, he went further. He said that even though he could not recall specifically making a recommendation to the commanding general in appellant's case, that knowing what he knows about this case, he would have recommended that the appellant be relieved for cause from his recruiting duties. Now, RCM 912 F1N requires the removal of a court-martial in the interest of having that court-martial free from substantial doubt as to legality, fairness, and partiality. Given Lieutenant Colonel Woods' statement that he already had made a preliminary finding as to the appellant's probable guilt, an objective observer might well have had doubts about the fairness of the appellant's court-martial.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
Did he say that he had already made a finding as to his probable guilt, or did he say that this was the type of package that he would have received and he examined what he would have done had he received it?
Sorry, what he said was, he said that he would have, I mean, it's unclear as far as exactly what he meant, but what he said was that he would have recommended that the appellant be relieved for cause.
But that's different from the statement that you made in your argument, where you argued that he had, in fact, made up his mind about this case. If that were the case, then we'd be dealing with actual bias, wouldn't we?
Sir, Our position is that in making or coming to a recommendation as to a relief for cause package, that he had to make a probable cause determination as to whether or not there was in fact a crime. And so what my argument was...
Well, hang on, what's the standard for relieving a recruiter? What's the standard for relieving a recruiter?
Sir, that is not available in the record of trial.
So the issue is, did he make a judgment as to whether this recruiter did this act, or whether did he make a judgment that he did this act using a criminal justice type standard? What are you arguing?
My argument is that it's not a criminal justice standard. Well, probably. What my argument is that he made a probable cause determination.
Where do you get probable cause from?
Just from simple experience in relief for cause, or making a for cause type determination.
But I just asked you, is there a standard for relief for cause? So
yes,
probable cause is your...
Yes, sir. It's my argument based on what I see in the record of trial.
But you are arguing that he made a judgment that the person should be relieved for cause full
stop. Yes, sir. And what I said was he made a preliminary finding that touches upon the appellant's guilt or innocence.
Well, the question that Judge Baker asked is one of the questions that I have, but I was preliminarily asking a different question. And that is, I understood from your recitation from the record that it is entirely possible in this case that he never saw this record.
It's entirely possible.
So that the issue, as I first understood you to state it, was not whether he did in fact have a particular view on this case, but that there are circumstances on the record which indicated that he may well have had a particular view on this case bearing on implied bias. That's why I was concerned about your assertion that he did, in fact, have certain views.
Yes, sir.
In this case, my understanding of the record, and please correct me if I've misread it, is that the defense is proceeding on the basis that we don't know whether or not he ever saw this package.
That's exactly.
You're dealing with the unresolved probabilities in the record that he did in fact see the package and that he saw evidence which was subsequently excluded from trial.
Why don't you go to the record on page 265, because I'm sure the government will explain to us as well how they read the same language. The member says, so based off of that, I believe I read the investigation as opposed to reading it. So he believes he did it. And then he says, do you feel you're called for making any kind of recommendation or anything like that? No, but I probably would have recommended relief if it had come up in front of me. I am assuming at that point that it did. I recommended relief to the CG. So both you and the government have to explain why that indicates one way or the other as to whether this person already did something in this case.
Yes, sir. That statement on 265 on the record, I believe, is
that case. Is that your where you're basing your argument?
Yes, sir. That's my basic argument right there, that dialogue right there. And that's where I get the assertion that he made a preliminary finding, where he said that even though I do not specifically recall making a recommendation, had I made a recommendation, I would have recommended that the appellant be relieved for cause. This was an unequivocal, straightforward statement from the Lieutenant Colonel Woods at that point.
Well, if he makes... He's the ACS, or
yes, sir.
Whatever he
the
is.
Assistant Chief of Staff.
He's the ACS at the time. Is it his province to make a recommendation, or is he simply signing off on a staff summary sheet that somebody else has prepared that's been through the legal office, among others, and is presumably now being sent to command section?
Yes, sir. I cannot answer that for sure. Just from reading the record and being around a while, I would think that he was certainly involved and making sure that he understood the facts underlying the investigation when he...
Well, then let's shove it back one niche.
Yes, sir.
Why should we assume he recommended relief for clause when the record is this unclear? Couldn't the defense counsel have cleared this up by asking about two or three questions that he didn't do?
Yes, sir. That's the thing. An interesting part of this is that the last thing that Lieutenant Colonel Woods said was, hey, I can't remember, but even... even without remembering, I will tell you that I would have recommended that this appellant, this accused, be relieved for cause.
Why are you focusing on, I am assuming at that point that I did. I can't remember, but I assume I did. Why isn't that the focus of your argument?
I can't remember.
One is a speculative thing, which is that, well, if it had come to me, this is what I would have done. But he says, I can't remember whether it came to me, but I assume that it did.
Yes, sir.
Why isn't that of note?
That is of note.
But so you're not focusing on that.
That's one of the three. Yes, sir. That's one of the three.
Your argument, but I.
Yes, sir. That's one of the three occasions where he said that he probably did. He said, I believe I did. I assume I did, and I probably did. And that probably did is when he said that even without recollection, I would have recommended that the appellant be relieved for cause.
Well, and that gets back to my other question. Is it simply reading this thing disqualifying? You know, what did he, if he acted on this thing and nobody knows the state of this record?
Yes, sir.
What would he have done? Would he have simply initialed it and kicked it into the CO? Would he have made a substantive recommendation? Would he have said, I concur? Or
it's hard.
We don't know.
It's hard to say. All we know is that he would recommend yay or nay, recommend relief, or recommend that just.
So what you're saying, we know he would have made a recommendation? Do we know that on this record? I thought you just told me we don't know how he acted on this thing, if he acted.
We do not know that.
Okay, thank you.
We cannot say that for sure. But we do know.
And why can't we say that?
Oh, I'm sorry. And we can't say that for sure. I was getting to the point where the defense counsel, after that point where, the Lieutenant Colonel Woods says, hey, I assumed that I did. From the defense counsel's standpoint, he assumes this is a challenge for cause right there. I mean, the person said, he was involved in this and made a preliminary determination, however, he probably did. So, from the defense counsel's standpoint, all he could do at that point was rehabilitate Lieutenant Colonel Woods, and that wasn't his job. So we see the defense counsel not ask any questions whatsoever and went straight toward the challenge of cause at the end of voir dire.
Okay, another question.
Yes, sir.
Was this objection preserved, given that he did not at the time state, when he made his preliminary, when he made his peremptory challenge, he did not at that time state that he would have...
Yes, sir.
Done it. He only did that in sentencing.
In the end, sir. Yes, he did. But he got it in the record. And there's no case law that said that it's not. And
no, but the rule seems to imply that it's got to be made contemporaneously.
That viewpoint would be contrary to the appellant's view, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Our view is that this was just a, shot from the he dropped the ball in that particular instance. And realized it before the conclusion of the trial, and actually told the trial judge what his intention was.
Well, for reasoning by analogy, if you object to, if you're going to object to something, you got to object to it when it's presented, not later. If you're objecting to the introduction of evidence,
yes, sir.
You can't, and it goes in and you say, hey, I should have objected. No good.
But our position was that the defense counsel wasn't really objecting. He was just merely stating for the record and telling this court and telling the military judge that had the military judge decided on that issue correctly, he would have challenged
the court. And your position is that does not have to be made contemporaneously with the preliminary challenge in order to preserve the issue.
Yes, sir. That is indeed our position.
Okay.
And our position also is that this court has a long-standing mantra that trial judges shall liberally grant defense challenges for cause and recognition of all those things particular to the military.
Just to be clear, when on the record did the defense counsel object to this member?
I believe it's on I have to tell you that in rebuttal. It's on page.
Okay. I just want to make sure that there's no... that we fix the exact point at which you and or the government agree the defense counsel did something.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
It's on page 562, Judge Ryan. This court has emphasized repeatedly the liberal grant mandate. We see that the military judge here failed to heed this court's guidance in that regard. We also see that when denying the appellant's challenge for cause, if you look at page, I believe it's 80, A2 of the joint appendix, you will see that it's clear that the military judge based his denial of appellant's challenge for cause exclusively on Lieutenant Colonel Wood's assertion that he'd be impartial and his statement that he does not have an inelastic predisposition. Okay, the military judge based his decision and denial solely upon that disclaimer. Now, it's the appellant's position that the rationale for the military judge's denial is inadequate for three reasons. First, Lieutenant Colonel Wood's statement that he could be impartial was perfunctory and lacked any support as to why he should be believed. The military judge compounded that situation by failing to take any steps on his own to make sure that Lieutenant Colonel Woods understood the standard of impartiality required of him in light of his particular circumstances and his possible involvement in the appellant's case prior to trial. The second reason that the explanation for denial is inadequate is that Lieutenant Colonel Woods' disclaimer was not unequivocal. If we look at page 62 of the Joint Appendix, you'll see this is the sole disclaimer here. You'll see that Lieutenant Colonel Woods told the judge, "I definitely feel that I could be impartial, but." At that point, the record demonstrates that the military judge cut Lieutenant Colonel Woods off and prevented Lieutenant Colonel Woods from finishing his answer, an answer he was clearly attempting to qualify. Now, as a result, when you look at that disclaimer, you will see as a result that Lieutenant Colonel Woods did not provide the unequivocal assurance that he could set aside any bias he might have and render an impartial verdict based on the evidence. The third reason is that assuming the military judge found Lieutenant Colonel Woods' disclaimer and assertion of impartiality complete and sincere, there were other facts uncontroverted on the record which raised the question of implied bias in this case. I see my time is up. If I could.
You may take the time you need to make a brief concluding statement.
Finish my thoughts. In sum, this court has said previously that when the totality of the circumstances raise the appearance of evil in the eye of disinterested observers, mere declarations or mere assertions of impartiality are not sufficient to ensure legal propriety. In other words, when there are several circumstances like there are now that raise the specter of implied bias, the military judge is required to actually go through some sort of implied bias analysis on the record. Had he done so, he would have been forced to encounter all these issues that we're talking about here that are absent on the record. There is no discourse whatsoever of implied bias, no discourse whatsoever of the liberal grant mandate. As such, we contend that this court should set aside the findings and sentence in this case and find for the company.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, I am Colonel Lou Puglio, along with Captain Jeffrey Shows. I represent the United States. The appellant did not establish on the record that Lieutenant Colonel W's presence as a member could, in the eyes of the public, raise a substantial doubt as to the legality, fairness, or impartiality of the accused court-martial. This, Your Honors, is not a close case. In an effort to make it easy for the court, the government proposes the following five categories in which implied bias does raise a possible prejudice in the case. But there are five categories that the government proposes, and this does not fall within one of those five categories. The standard is well known. It is whether, viewed through the eyes of the public, objectively viewed, the appellant received something less than a court-martial composed of fair and impartial members. That is the standard. But like beauty, that objective standard is a subjective analysis. And in fact, this court in United States versus Townsend split on that very issue. The majority finding this was not a close case, the dubitante opinion finding that it was a close case. The government would invite this court's attention to generally five broad categories where you have implied bias and they rise to the level of a closed case. The first is where there exists some close relationship.
I'm sorry, but I'm anxious to ask my question, and you could filibuster us with the five categories. I don't know if that's the intent. But at the end, we'll make sure you get your five categories on. Without arguing facts yet, if a potential member recommends that someone, we're going to stipulate this because we're not going to get to the facts yet, if you recommend that someone be relieved for cause because they did something, do you think that same person can sit on a jury that will evaluate whether that person did something?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it goes to the standards.
It goes, well, I think we have to look at the relief for cause and what the standard is.
Okay, let me play this out just a little bit further to make sure I understand what you're arguing. And again, I'm stipulating here. It's not a trick to get you to read the record like the other side or something. Let's say Lieutenant Colonel Wood says, I distinctly remember the case. I recommended to the commanding general that he be relieved for cause for having sex with a potential recruit. I recommended that he be relieved. May he sit on a jury that is hearing a case involving whether the recruiter engaged in rape.
That, Your Honor, is certainly a closer case than implied bias standard. But to get to your question directly, yes, we believe he still can, because if you look at the Article 32, Appellate Exhibit 15, it sets forth what the standard is for relief for cause. And that standard is any unprofessional personal contact between a recruiter and either a recruit or a potential recruit. There is no burden of proof. There is no adversarial process. It's not a judicial or quasi-judicial.
So applying a public perception, the government's position is that's fine. So it does not matter to the government whether he believes he did it, could recall, couldn't recall, et cetera. The facts, in effect, are not relevant. I mean, they may make it further on a continuum, but you're permanently on this side of the line, in your view.
Yes, sir. That was strictly an administrative matter, and given the high standards that we hold recruiters to, any allegation of misconduct, whether it's criminal or not, is irrelevant to the relief for cause decision.
Is the reasonable person standing outside as a member of the public a reasonable lawyer, or is he just a reasonable layman?
For what purposes?
For evaluating whether this looks bad to the public, whether it brings the military justice system for imposing an implied bias standard. Is he not a layman? Is a layman going to understand or care about the difference between proof beyond a reasonable doubt and some lower standard, or is he just going to look at the fact that this guy recommended relief and now he's sitting on the court?
Well, I believe the court, and the case that will come to me, but the court has said when it's viewing this the reasonable person standard in an implied bias test, they have to assume that the person understands Article 25 and understands the military justice system. That is incorporated into this reasonable person analysis. And if you want, Your Honor, if you give me a minute, I will find that.
I'll give you some time that you can stall while you answer my question and you're looking for it. Back to the stipulation that he did, in fact, our pretend stipulation, not the case. He recommends relief. Does that also mean that he hasn't been exposed to the facts of this case or to the case in the stipulation?
No.
So he recommends relief based on nothing. It's just his practice to send empty memos up.
He could recommend relief just based upon the allegation. And in this case, the information that the member had was similar to the information that the member had in Napoleon. He knew that there was a crime. He knew generally the location of the crime. He knew something about the victim, as in Napoleon. And he knew that the police were involved and there was an investigation. Just based upon those factors and those factors alone, as the assistant chief of staff for the recruiting, he could have said, relief for cause, there is, this person should not be dealing as a recruiter with the public because of the high standards we set forth for recruiters. Has nothing to do with his guilt or innocence in a criminal matter.
Let's to the stipulation one more time. If he were exposed to facts, I understand you've now turned my, in theory, legal question into a factual response. If he had been exposed to facts, different case?
I
understand you said we don't know because he could have just said I recommend relief, whatever. But let's say it's played out full description.
I think you have a continuum here. You have Napoleon on one side of the continuum where you don't find implied bias, and Marino on the other side of the continuum where you do find implied bias. And one of the categories that the government would recommend is, does the member have extensive knowledge of the case? In Napoleon, the member knew just very briefly that, like I said, there was an allegation of a crime, that it was a stabbing, that it happened in the commissary parking lot, and that, it happened in the parking lot of the club, and that the victim worked in the commissary. That's what the member knew in Napoleon, and this court found no implied bias.
In Napoleon, did the member acquire that information as part of his official duties, and was he required to make a recommendation on it?
No, it's unclear in Napoleon. As I recall, he got it from newspaper and from discussions among the staff. There were staff meeting discussions that concerned us, because it was a club, and there were staff meetings about problems at the, I guess it was enlisted.
But it didn't appear that he was making any official recommendation or action based upon that information.
No, not in Napoleon. In Marino, however, the other end of the continuum, to answer your question, Justice Baker, in Napoleon, you had the deputy controller who was required to make a specific investigation and recommendation to the comptroller about the case. He went out, he interviewed witnesses, he looked at logbooks, he interviewed the duties, the duty personnel involved, he made an extensive recommendation and report to the comptroller in the case, and then afterwards he actively kept involved in the case. He followed the case actively. So this case falls closer to the Napoleon case than it does to the Marino case.
How so? Marino was doing this as far as official duties. Well, if we push aside the problems of this record and assume arguendo that he acted on this in the course of his duties, how is that not Marino rather than Napoleon?
The government respectfully disagrees, sir. And here, Lieutenant Colonel W. did not go out as the deputy comptroller did in Marino and actively investigated the case.
No, but he read a file having to do with the event. He obviously had, you know, he would have had substantially more knowledge than your average person.
Again, we disagree. The facts do not bear this, sir. He says the only facts that he can recall,
No, I'm assuming arguendo that he acted on this. Now, of course, if he did not act on it, then the issue goes away.
Okay. Well, let's assume, Your Honor, then, that he acted on this case.
Right.
What did he remember about this case? He remembered that there was a rape, and that was brought out by the charge sheet. He remembered that the victim was the boyfriend of a recruit in the pool. That was brought out both by the victim and by the boyfriend who testified. Both of those so far are uncontested. He said that the police were involved, uncontested matter, and in fact, there were three witnesses from the Riverside Police Department that testified. And the fourth matter was that there was some bodily fluids or some evidence collected at the site. And uncontested, the victim in this case testified, and so did the police, I believe, that the appellant ejaculated on the floor. It is not beyond the ken of the average person in our CSI world to know that when you have semen on the floor, it's more likely than not that the police would go collect that evidence.
What about the suppressed evidence in this case? How do we know he wasn't exposed to it?
We know that, sir, if you look at Joint Appendix page 36, when he looks at the investigation, when he says something about investigation, he says a preliminary inquiry. Under our system in the Navy and the Marine Corps, a preliminary inquiry is done through a JAG manual. It's a separate investigation done under Chapter 2 of the JAG manual, where you have an independent officer go out and do a brief investigation of the facts. He never says he saw the police report. And the burden here is on the defense to show that there are sufficient facts on the record to raise substantial doubts as to the fairness of the proceedings.
Well, he doesn't even know that he saw anything. Well, he doesn't even know that he saw this any record whatsoever in this case.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But I was assuming the fact that he did.
But he doesn't recall. So the member doesn't recall, and you say, well, that's tough. We can't test for his bias because he doesn't recall. That's the defense counsel's problem.
No, Your Honor. In United States versus Dilettante, and clearly it's distinguishable from Dilettante, but for the moment, allow me to make the argument. In United States versus Dilettante, the member there was in charge of the medical facility, and Colonel David, I believe her name was, and she reviewed all the sanity board proceedings, including the privileged sanity board proceedings. The appellant in Dilettante went through the sanity board. The member stated, you know what, I reviewed these records, I don't remember seeing this one, but I do review these things. The defense in that case said, but wait a minute, if during the course of the trial, if your memory is jogged and you do remember these things, that's going to prejudice the court martial. This court rejected that line of argument and said, no, the member said she did not remember. The member said that even if she did remember, she could set aside anything outside the court martial, just like we have here.
Counsel?
This member, yes, ma'am.
No, I'm sorry, finish your thought and then I have a question.
This member stated that throughout all the vagaries, and he is struggling, you could see on the record, he is struggling to remember, and he cannot remember, and he's trying to give this court an honest opinion as to what he does remember. If we are going to allow him that, we should also allow him that his answers were honest and forthright when he said, I could put aside anything I may or may not have seen and judge this case squarely on the merits, being unbiased. If we are to grant him
That's a different issue than saying, then that's a fair argument, but that's a different argument than saying defense counsel has failed to demonstrate that he saw the package.
Well,
if the guy didn't recall, how can you demonstrate? Or is there a way? Are you saying the defense counsel should have subpoenaed or tried to get a hold of the package?
Well, I think...
Is that what you're arguing? If
you're asking the government, Your Honor, to try the defense's case, if I were defense counsel, I would have gotten the relief for cause package. I would have gone through it. I would have seen if the relief for cause package matched or had the police report in it. I would have asked the member if he remembered seeing the police report. So there's a whole heck of a lot that the defense
could have done more in your view, in the government's view.
I'm sorry?
The defense counsel could have done more is what you're saying.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Well, here's a related question, which you may be able to answer now, which is the colonel makes clear in his answers to the military judge that, you know, what he saw would have depended when it was available to be seen because he changed jobs. And my question for you is it possible to tell from the record, from his members' questionnaire, from the timing of the offense, whether he was at that position or not when the alleged incident occurred?
When the incident occurred, he was at the position because he left in July 17th. He said anything after July 17th, in fact, he says it became history. So unlike the member in Marino who kept an active involvement in the case, here the member said, look, if it happened after July 17th, it's all history. I don't know.
Well, when did it happen?
When did the event happen?
Yes.
He was sure. The Article 32 was, I know you didn't ask me this question, but the Article 32 was on 24 July 2003. The report was done on 30 July 2003.
Well, I think that we had established earlier that the actual incident happened on 10 April. So how long do you think the Marine Recruiting Command would wait around to making a request for review or for cause or whatever this thing is. Would they wait until after July 17th?
No, Your Honor, and that is exactly the point. They cannot have, and if I didn't answer your question, ma'am.
No, you did.
I apologize. That's exactly the point, sir. If, because the relief for cause, and again, if you go to IE 15 of the 32, they're held to a higher standard. So any non-professional personal contact is subject to disciplinary review. We clearly cannot have recruiters out there who, even if innocent, there's an allegation of rape, we cannot have them interacting with young men and women.
Counsel, can you establish for us on the record that a mere allegation is necessarily the grounds for will result in relief for cause as opposed to being within the discretion of a commander?
I'm sorry.
That is, as I understand the record in this case, there is nothing that would establish that an allegation of misconduct necessarily results in relief for cause. There has to be an affirmative decision on the part of the relieving authority that relief for cause is warranted.
Somebody has to make the decision, yes, Your Honor. And in this case, I think it's on the record that, again, if you look to Appellate Exhibit 15, both the depot order and the Marine Corps order established this non-professional personal conflict. And it appears on the record that the commanding general of the Western Recruiting Region is the one who ultimately makes the relief for cause decision. Because
but you were perhaps implying, but perhaps not implying, I may have misunderstood, that an allegation of misconduct necessarily results in relief for cause.
Maybe not necessarily, but okay. An allegation of misconduct, if it's out there, I'm speculating that.
Not asking you to speculate or testify.
There seems to be, at least on Appellate Exhibit 15, that such allegations would engender some administrative action. I cannot tell this court in good faith that 100% of the time it does and how solid the allegation is. I think it's a matter of discretion with the commanding general of the Western Recruiting Region.
I may have interrupted your response to another question here.
Would you agree that under the timelines in this case that the relief for cause would have come up to the recruiting command when Lieutenant Colonel Wood was the Assistant Chief of Staff recruiting? Given the fact that he left that position on the 17th of April and the incident happened on the 10th, or 17th of July, and the incident happened on the 10th of April.
Quite honestly, Your Honor, I cannot speculate. In fact, the government tried to get the relief for cause package, and because it's more than 2 years old, all that stuff was destroyed, at least at the recruiting level and at the Quantico, the headquarters.
But I thought you had earlier said that the recruiting command cannot sit around on its hands and wait to relieve one of these individuals. So that would indicate that these relief for causes happen relatively quickly and certainly before 2 or 3 months has elapsed.
Yes, sir. That would be reasonable to assume that.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
In 32 seconds, can you state your five categories?
I'll exercise my...
6 seconds per category.
Now, my prerogative here. Counsel, you may take the time that you feel necessary without unduly laboring it to articulate those categories as you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll go right to the first category is whether there exists some close relationship between the member and some aspect of the litigation. And under this broad general category, there are really three prongs, if you will, on this first one. The one where there's evidence of substantial emotional involvement or investment. For instance, in Clay, where the member had a moral conviction that a rape of a young child was an outrageous.
Now, the rules are you have to give your outline, but you're not allowed to make arguments.
Okay, but the first is this evidence of potential substantial involvement under that first prong. The second under that first prong is whether the member has a close relationship or was a victim of a crime or similar crime as charged. The third factor under that first prong is whether the member has a close relationship to be one of the parties for the witnesses in the litigation, or is there some other associational link between the members and one of the parties of the litigation? That would be the first one. The second one is when the member conceals or misleads the court concerning important facts during voir dire in order to sit in judgment on the case. The third one is, was extensive rehabilitation required by the military judge or the trial counsel in order to get the member to say the right thing when you have that extensive rehabilitation and questioning? The fourth one is, did the member have an extensive level of pretrial knowledge or involvement in the case? I cited Mario before. And the final one, is there an aspect of command influence? And I have cases to back up all this, but I understand the purpose.
And counsel, I just want to clarify that it's the existence of one of these five factors that, in your view, would make it a close case.
Would raise the specter of implied bias and make it closer. Whether it's a close case and what that entails, this court has stated that there's that closer scrutiny, less deference, more deference.
You're in the game, but you're not. Right. That's not outcome determinative.
Well, it's not fatal, but you are in. You're in the stadium.
But to make clear, what you would like us to do is to say, from henceforth, implied bias has to be in one of these categories.
We would invite the court to look at those five categories and rule that way, so it would make it easier both for the criminal justice system and the judges to say, here's what it is, and for this court to say, does it fit within one of those categories? Yes, sir. If there are no further questions, I see I'm over my time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your presentation. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, just to make sure we understand the timeline, in the record we find that the appellant was arrested on 10 April 2003 and that his Article 32 was originally scheduled for the 6th of June 2003, that it was continued by the defense counsel until 3rd of July 2003. At least that's the date of the Article 32 investigation. We know that Lieutenant Colonel Woods left his billet on the 17th of July, 2003. So with those dates in mind, we know that while this investigation was going on, Lieutenant Colonel Smith was in his position as the Assistant Chief of Staff to the Commanding General of CRB San Diego, the convening authority in this case. And it's interesting that one of the five aspects from the government was the aspect of command influence, because that indeed is raised here. When we consider that Lieutenant Colonel Woods was the Assistant Chief of Staff to this Commanding General, the convening authority.
But at the time that he was sitting as a member on this court martial, at the time that he was being voir dire, he didn't work for the CGMCRD.
He did. In fact, there's also another distinction there that at the time of the investigation of the allegations in April, there was a different commanding general in that spot. I think it was Brigadier General Paxton. Major General Hewley. He convened the court on the 28th of August, 2003. Lieutenant Colonel Woods was selected as a panel member in June of 2004, right before the actual trial.
By the same CA or not?
By a different CA. He was actually appointed or selected to be a panel member by Brigadier General Paxton, Jr. But nonetheless, in the eyes of the public, this indeed raises the appearance of impropriety here, because we have same Lieutenant Colonel Woods, who was Assistant Chief of Staff, selected as a panel member. In closing, are there any questions in relation to this? In closing, the appellant would like to state that since the military judge exclusively relied on the member's assertion of impartiality and his claiming that he could be, that he wouldn't be predisposed, and failed to address the implied bias analysis, and failed to address the liberal grant mandate, we ask this court to set aside the findings in this case and set aside the findings in this case. There are no further questions. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you, counsel. And without inviting, and I'm not inviting argument from the government here, there are a number of references to the record. Does the government have anything that they would like to add specifically with respect to the references of the record made during the rebuttal? We'll make our own evaluation as to how to interpret that. Thank you. The case is now submitted. The court will stand in recess. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. We'll stand in recess until 6 p.m. tomorrow night, at which point we will reconvene at George Mason University to hear United States against Gallagher.
The court stands in recess until 6 p.m. tomorrow.